93.3.
The rhymes you're about to hear me recite are dedicated to all of those that bite.
Little Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Morocco and Israel have agreed to establish diplomatic relations as part of a U.S. brokered deal. Morocco, the fourth Arab nation to establish ties with Israel since August. As part of the deal, the United States agreed to become the first country in the world to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over occupied Western Sahara, what many consider to be Africa's last colony. It's due to open a consulate in the occupied city of Dakhla, where there are few, if any, U.S. citizens. Morocco's occupied much of the resource-rich territory since 1975 in defiance of the United Nations and the international community. Thousands of Sahrawis have been tortured, imprisoned, killed, and disappeared while resisting the Moroccan occupation. Following Morocco's invasion in 1975, about half the Sahrawi population fled to neighboring Algeria, where they've lived for the past 45 years in refugee camps in the middle of the desert. The deal comes less than a month after a nearly three-decade-old ceasefire ended in Western Sahara. Joining us in the United States, Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, the co-author of Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Resolution, Irresolution. Stephen Zunis, if you can make that link between Morocco recognizing Israel and the U.S. in exchange, it seems, officially accepting Morocco's annexation of the occupied Western Sahara.
It was clearly a quid pro quo, though the United States has been, in effect, supporting Morocco's occupation for many years, just as it has been supporting Israel's occupation for many years. Trump, in both cases, has gone well beyond what previous administrations of both parties have done and violated longstanding international legal norms. In the case of Palestine, recognizing Jerusalem as solely Israel's capital, moving the U.S. embassy there, and recognizing Israel's illegal annexation of the Syria's Golan Heights. In the case of Morocco, it's even worse, because it's not just talking about recognizing an illegal annexation of a portion of a country, but an annexation of an entire country. And in the case of Western Sahara, remember, Western Sahara, the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, has been recognized by over 80 nations around the world and is a full member of the African Union. in a sense, Trump is not recognizing the takeover of one African nation by another. Again, this is unprecedented since the signing of the United Nations Charter for the United States or any nation, really, to recognize such a brazen violation of international legal norms.
I wanted to go right now inside occupied Western Sahara to El Aaiun to speak with Nasha El Khalidi, who is inside her home, where many are in their homes, but police have laid siege to the area. And Nasha, I wanted to welcome you to Democracy Now! You're a journalist as well with Equipe Media. You've been arrested by the Moroccans. Can you respond to the Trump administration recognizing Morocco's sovereignty over your territory and what this means for you? What is the situation inside?
Thank you very much, Amy Goodman, and thanks to Democracy Now! For talking to us and give to the Sahrawi activists from the occupied territory of Western Sahara the opportunity to share their stories and to share testimonies of victims. Regarding the situation in the occupied territory, there is a major crackdown on the Sahrawi rights, on the Sahrawi, on the freedom of speech, on the freedom of movement, on the freedom of assembly, especially after Morocco violated the ceasefire and the wars start again. Morocco started a wave of arrests against Sahrawi activists in the occupied territory. The oppression and the repression against the Sahrawi peaceful movements raising day by day, and Morocco keep arresting people. Now they are dozens of Sahrawi activists who are behind bars in Moroccan prisons. The people in Western Sahara are not allowed to express themselves. There are no press agencies in the ground that can document the violations against Sahrawi human beings in here. Morocco is continue closing the territory in front of the international observer, international activists, and international journalists. So we determined and we described Western Sahara as a black hole, as it was described by RSF reports 2 years ago and by international organizations. It's completely closed and we are suffered in silence. Regarding the Donald Trump recognition, we believe that this will not erase our legitimate right to freedom and independence. Sahrawi people is continue struggling, and we are not surprised since we have been betrayed by the international community for over 30 years, where we were waiting for a peaceful solution from the United Nations that we have been promised by the United Nations. And there is a mission to organize a fair referendum and to offer the opportunity to Sahrawi people to vote and to determine their own future by themselves. So we are not surprised by the recognition from Trump. And I think the statute of Western Sahara is already determined by international law, so not by a tweet of a president who is already in his way out. So the international law is clear and is set out in successive United Nations Security Council resolutions that were authored by the U.S. itself. And that Western Sahara statute will be determined by a referendum. We hope that the new U.S. administration will resolve the long-standing conflict in Western Sahara and help deliver what the Sahrawi people have long been promised by the United Nations, which is a promise to give them a simple right, which is the vote for our freedom. So the Donald Trump recognition will not stop the Sahrawi struggle and will not end the Sahrawi beliefs in achieving a legal rights and fighting for legal rights, which is independence, and establish their state on their land.
Finally, I wanted to ask Steve Zunis about this latest report in Reuters that talks about the U.S. planning to sell, negotiating the sale of at least 4 sophisticated large aerial drones to Morocco. Not clear whether it is related to this, though it's coming at the same time. And you have the longtime supporter of Israel, the outgoing congressman, head of the House Foreign Relations Committee, Elliot Engel, while applauding the relationship between Jerusalem and Rabat, warned the Trump administration against casting aside legitimate multilateral avenues of conflict resolution, doing something no other country in the world has done. Professor Zunis, you have 30 seconds.
The drone sale is of concern because it's illegal for the United States to support to provide invading armies with this kind of sophisticated equipment. But now that Western Sahara is recognized as part of Morocco, suddenly it's an internal conflict, and so this paves the way for this kind of equipment, which could be used in counterinsurgency situations. In terms of Engel, it's important that someone who is so strongly pro-Israel is willing to break with the administration on this point. The question is what Biden's going to do, because Biden could reverse the recognition of the annexation with a stroke of a pen, but he'd be under a lot of pressure, because then Morocco could use this as an excuse to nullify their recognition of Israel. So Biden's going to be in a lot of pressure by pro-Israel groups not to rescind Trump's order. So it's good that you have somebody like Engel who is challenging the Trump's decision.
Harry!
Morocco and Israel have agreed to establish diplomatic relations as part of a U.S. brokered deal. Morocco is the fourth Arab nation to establish ties with Israel since August. As part of the deal, the United States agreed to become the first country in the world to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over occupied Western Sahara, what many consider to be Africa's last colony. It's due to open a consulate in the occupied city of Dakhla, where there are few, if any, U.S. citizens. Morocco's occupied much of the resource-rich territory since 1975 in defiance of the United Nations and the international community. Thousands of Sahrawis have been tortured, imprisoned, killed, and disappeared while resisting the Moroccan occupation. Following Morocco's invasion in 1975, about half of the Sahrawi population fled to neighboring Algeria, where they have lived for the past 45 years in refugee camps in the middle of the desert. The deals come less than a month after a nearly three-decade-old ceasefire ended in Western Sahara. In November, the Moroccan military broke into a no-go buffer zone in southern Western Sahara to attack Sahrawi civilians, blocking off a Moroccan-built road and exchange fire with the Polisario Front, the Sahrawi liberation movement seeking independence. Morocco since intensified its repression in occupied Western Sahara, raiding and laying siege to the homes of pro-independence activists and journalists, arresting dozens of people and cracking down on protests. Human rights groups criticize the U.S.-Morocco-Israel deal, which was announced on International Human Rights Day. In Washington, Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont said, quote, after losing his own bid for re-election, President Trump cannot, by proclamation, negate international law or the rights of the people of Western Sahara. They're entitled to what they have long been promised, a free and fair vote on self-determination. In 1991, the United Nations promised Sahrawis a referendum on self-determination as part of a ceasefire deal, but Morocco has blocked the referendum from happening. Bassam al-Sahi of the Palestine Liberation Organization also condemned Morocco for joining Bahrain, Sudan, and the United Arab Emirates in establishing ties with Israel despite the ongoing occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. He said the deal is unacceptable and warned it will embolden, quote, Israel's belligerence at its denial of the Palestinian people's rights. We're joined right now by Hanan Ashrawi, the longtime Palestinian diplomat and scholar. She recently resigned her position executive committee member of the Palestine Liberation Organization. She was the first woman to hold a seat in the highest executive body in Palestine. She's joining us right now from the West Bank. We welcome you to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. If you can start off by talking about the Morocco-Israel part of this deal.
Well, this is part of a whole pattern of behavior, a process whereby the U.S., the Trump administration, has been acting as the errand boy for Israel in order to try to get as many victories, as many benefits, as many privileges for Israel. And right now it's rushing like mad in a race against time before they leave office, in order to reposition Israel, to normalize relations with the Arab world, and to deliver Palestine to Israel, and to legalize or legitimize the occupation of Palestine and the land theft of Palestine and the escalation and the, sorry, annexation of land, as well as the building of settlements and so on. So this pattern, in many ways, utilized very not just illegal, but cruel means. I said it's between bribery and blackmail. And it uses the weak spots in different countries and the needs of different countries in order to supply them on behalf of Israel and extract concessions for Israel. Now, for the look at the UAE, look at Bahrain, who's also in normalized with Israel and is in trouble, look at now Morocco. Now, the instability in many different countries, look at Sudan, of course, which is another tragic case, was exploited, and the weakness of certain, and the needs of certain regimes and rulers were also exploited in order to extract these privileges and so on for Israel and reposition it as a major power in the region, and to give it a free hand and to enable it to be part of what they call the Sunni moderate bloc in facing Iran and the Shia. Now, with Morocco, it's different from the issue of Sudan and the Gulf countries, because Sudan, of course, needed to be removed off the terrorist list and needed the blockade to be lifted. Morocco wanted Israel, wanted the U.S. to recognize and accept its control and its annexation, control over and annexation of the Western Sahara. And the different countries in the world, the UN and so on, do not recognize Moroccan control or annexation of the Western Sahara. Neither did the U.S. This is a change in U.S. policy, and it's a violation of U.N. resolutions that granted the Sahrawis, the Western Sahara, self-determination. In the same way as the Palestinians are every year told that they have the right to self-determination. But with the implementation, we never get it. So this has created, again, a situation of quid pro quo, where the U.S. exploits the weakness or the avarice of other countries in order to bring them to normalize with Israel and in order to break Arab ranks, to destroy the Arab Peace Initiative, to violate successive Arab resolutions, and to place Israel in the heart of the region as a major economic, military, security power. Now, Morocco, grantedly, there's an article in the New York Times, I think, today, has been cooperating secretly. The Moroccan regime, I don't want to say the people, because the Moroccan people are among the most supportive of the Palestinian cause. They identify with Palestine. So they're very unhappy with what's happening. They're very unhappy with the normalization with Israel. And they know that normalizing with Israel means normalizing the occupation, means normalizing lawlessness. It means that they are giving Israel a free hand to continue with its policies against Palestine. And we are seeing how, in these last days of the Trump administration, Israel has escalated and intensified its settlement activities, its home demolition of the Palestinian people, its superimposing an apartheid system now totally on the West Bank in particular, and its illegal annexation of Jerusalem, and creating rings of settlements to isolate Jerusalem and to fragment the West Bank, knowing that it has the blessings of this U.S. administration and knowing full well that destroys any chances of peace in the same way as it destroys the chance of having a viable, territorially contiguous Palestinian state.
So what exactly does it mean, Hanan Ashrawi, to have Bahrain, Sudan, the United Arab Emirates and Morocco recognize Israel? How does that change things on the ground for Gaza and the West Bank?
It just emboldens Israel even further. It's not a question of recognition or making peace, as the Trump administration claims. There was no war. I mean, they don't share borders with Israel. They've never had a war with Israel, neither Morocco, nor the Emirates, nor Bahrain, nor Sudan. So in a sense, what they're doing is looking for any place where they can have agreements and normalization, as they say, in order to say they made peace. And you see, the Palestinian question is not central and is not a prerequisite to peace, and the Arab Peace Initiative is no longer applicable, and that Israel can have all the fruits of what is called peace and normalization without having to pay its dues in terms of compliance with international law. So this, of course, does weaken the Palestinian position. The U.S. administration has taken several unilateral and illegal steps in order to bash the Palestinians into submission, and it failed. It says, you know, now it's very clear that they have fragmented the Arab position. They have created and enhanced fault lines within the region. They are supporting artificial polarization, and they are creating further rifts between the people and their leadership, and they are supporting more autocratic or despotic regimes. And we think that the Trump administration has been acting like one, and outside the law. So now, of course, the Palestinians know that this weakens their hand. They know that this, in many ways, undermines the Arab unanimous support for the Palestinian cause. The regimes themselves may have taken such self-serving and illegal positions, but the people, the Arab people as a whole, remain committed and remain supportive of the Palestinian cause. Now, Israel feels that it is not only above the law that it can do whatever it wants, but it has partners in crime. First, it was the American administration that entered into collusion or complicity with Israel. Now it is dragging Arab countries or Arab leaders in order to do the same. And it went so far as the Emiratis have been signing agreements with the settlers and with the settler business groups. And we keep reminding people settlements are illegal. They are a war crime, according to the Rome Statute and the ICC. And anybody who cooperates or supports or aids and abets a war crime can be held accountable as well. But they're moving so fast and they're creating situations that are so volatile, I think, that they will introduce more instability in the region. It is an abnormal situation. It is a result of specific needs. It was the need for Netanyahu to be able to get reelected. It was the need for Trump to say he's a peacemaker before November. Now it's a question of fulfilling requirements in order to appeal to his constituency, whether it is the extreme right-wing Zionist evangelicals or whether it is the pro-Israel lobby or whether it is his funders like Sheldon Adelson and others. This has become a pattern that is very disruptive, that is illegal in many ways.
Hanan Ashrawi, can you address why you stepped down from the PLO leadership? Explain your decision.
Okay, well, I did issue a statement and I did speak out, but it's a question of actually fulfilling not just a promise, but a pledge. It is practicing what you preach in many ways, in the sense that I believe it is time for the PLO to be reformed, for the institutions to be rejuvenated, for the democratic process to take place, to have elections, and to elect new leadership, particularly young men and women, and to reform the system, and of course to respect our institutions and their role. There have been several instances and issues, which I don't want to discuss, I mean, right now, but I did discuss them with the president, that I felt have weakened and undermined the standing of the PLO and our decision-making, and the continued continued the rift, which was not in our benefit, and it had weakened the Palestinian position internationally and in terms of standing up to Israeli violations. So there's a long list of things, but I feel it's time. And I've been trying to leave for some time now, and I wanted to practice what we call the graceful exit, in order to make room for others, and perhaps this will trigger others or trigger more reform or trigger the meeting of the institutions of the PLO in order to elect a new leadership. And we do need the elections and a genuine revitalization of the system and an exercise of democracy.
Finally, can you address the issue of the pandemic, COVID-19, in the occupied territories? You tested positive for COVID. You have Saab Erekat, the chief PLO negotiator, who died of COVID. Can you talk about the situation and how you recovered?
Certainly. It's really drastic. It's extremely dangerous. We have lockdowns every weekend, but that's not enough. There is no movement between different districts and so on, but the situation is rapidly threatening to get out of control. Actually, we don't know, but we still has any vaccine or medicine. But the thing is, we are under occupation. We do not control our borders, our crossing points, entrance and exit. Israel controls everything. And as such, in many cases, people who come in or go out and so on are subject to Israeli control and what Israel does and says. and therefore we were unable to control our borders and the workers who go to Israel or Palestinians from Israel who come to visit families and have social occasions, because we are one people, the indigenous Palestinians in Israel. We call them the 48 Palestinians. So it has created a situation where there is really no control, and we don't have a health system, despite the fact that we have very qualified doctors and a Ministry of Health that has been working extremely hard to try to control it. It did at first. It acted quickly. It controlled the situation. And then with the second wave, it became worse. And now we're going through the third wave, where every day we have more than 2,000 cases. And we have deaths in by the scores, which, given the number of people we have, is a very high ratio. And we don't have enough health facilities, the hospitals, and even the swabs, the needed treatment medicine.
So let me ask you then, the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, says he will be the very first person to get a COVID vaccine, to be injected with one. What will happen to the Palestinians? What kind of access will you have?
Well, the president has been talking to many different countries, and every time he addresses a leader of a country, like in Russia and other places, he does ask for the vaccine. And the Ministry of Health has been in touch with the pharmaceutical companies that are manufacturing this vaccine. So we have to get it ourselves, and we have to pay for it. But at the same time, we're addressing other countries to be able to help in terms of acquiring the necessary vaccines. We don't expect to get them soon. We don't have the means to buy enough for the whole population. So I think there will be several countries that have volunteered to help, to assist, but it means we'll have to wait a while to be able to get it. And the fact that it is becoming more prevalent, it is spreading quite rapidly. I was talking to the Minister of Health, Dr. May. She's quite a hardworking, excellent health practitioner, and she told me that they're desperately trying to get enough, and she's in touch with many different sources, and we hope through the WHO and others there will be help. But they're worried that if we do not get it quickly, the hospitals and the ICU facilities will not be enough to take care of them. We do have good and qualified health service providers, and we trust them, but at the same time, we don't know if they can cope with the scope of the spread of the COVID-19 in Palestine.
Israel and the South Asian country of Bhutan announced they're establishing full diplomatic relations. The agreement does not appear to be related to recent U.S. brokered normalization deals between Israel and four Arab nations, the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, and just last week, Morocco. Meanwhile, the U.S. has adopted a new official map of Morocco, which now includes the disputed territory of Western Sahara, following its recognition last week of Morocco's sovereignty over occupied Western Sahara, what many consider to be Africa's last colony, which was part of the normalization deal between Morocco and Israel.
فيديكم لمانا ولا مانا حمل Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast. At Mondo Weiss, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. On today's show, I talked to Olivia Cotby-Smith about what it's like being attacked online by white nationalists and Zionists at the same time. Olivia Cotby-Smith is the national U.S. organizer for the BDS movement. She is also the co-chair of the Portland, Oregon chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Over the last few weeks, Olivia has been the target of online attacks. First, a member of the right-wing Proud Boys posted her personal information online. A few days later, Olivia's Twitter account, with over 20,000 followers, was suspended after another Twitter account labeled her the, quote, anti-Semite of the week. Olivia, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, of course. Always happy to talk to Mondo Weiss.
Tell us about this online harassment you've been dealing with for the last few weeks.
So there was an anonymous account that posted a chart claiming to map all of Antifa on 4chan and on Twitter recently. It had all of these dots with people's names on it connected to one another. And I was the biggest red dot. This map was sort of painting me as a high value target, like as the leader of Antifa in Portland. They said that they created this by war driving protesters using a honeypot, basically they said they created a free Wi-Fi network that alleged Antifa members joined during the protests against police violence that happened in Portland over the summer, and then tracked the Antifa network that way. When you look at these maps, it's very clearly like social media connections. So my cousins in Ohio are on this list. My sister-in-law and her husband in Germany are on this list. Like it's very clearly a list of my Facebook friends, but this was taken as truth. Like this is Antifa. So this was posted on 4chan, on Twitter. It has been spreading like wildfire across all of these right-wing forums. And I've gotten a lot of threats, a lot of harassment. They posted my address that has been circulating. It's been a really scary time the past couple of weeks.
So this doxing attack was inspired by your leadership role in Portland's DSA and connected to the anti-police violence protests there, not because of your BDS work.
Yeah, and I mean, I've always been public about my activism in DSA. And this person took advantage of that and made me a target because of that publicity that my name Portland with these protests. They're like, well, her, she's the target. She's the leader of Antifa. We're just gonna research her Facebook friends and say we did this like sophisticated hack and say that Antifa is this massive coordinated network with ties to the DNC and CARE. They're upset because I am on the board of CARE. They're obsessed with that. You know, all these conspiracies swirling around Portland Antifa and with myself at the helm.
Tell us about the lawsuit you've launched against the one individual believed to be the person that carried out this doxing.
Yes. So the doxer actually got doxed back by a group called the Anonymous Comrade Collective. His name is Chadwick Jason Seagraves, and he lives in North Carolina, actually. He is a Proud Boy, and he's attended and spoken at Proud Boy rallies. He works at North Carolina State University. They have said they're launching an investigation, and that's the last I've heard on that matter. We filed the lawsuit last week, and we'll see what happens.
What effect has this doxing had on you and your family?
Yeah, it's caused a lot of emotional and nearly physical harm. You know, I don't want to say too much about the details because it's because of the ongoing law. But I do hope that he has to face legal consequences for what he's done. I know that he's already facing the personal consequences of his employer launching an investigation into him. But it's been really scary. And I hope that no one else has to go through this. I mean, there was a kill list that was put out in Portland that I was on, along with 19 other activists. And it was mailed to one of my comrades' houses. And, you know, these are the kinds of things that this person who, you know, might claim that he doesn't want anyone to cause physical harm. It doesn't matter what he wants. He puts this information out there with a purpose, and people are wanting to act on it.
Just a few days after this doxing happened, Olivia was again attacked online by an organization called StopAntisemitism.org, run by a woman named Leora Reznichenko. It is funded, at least in part, by the Milstein Family Foundation. Adam Milstein funds a wide array of right-wing groups, including the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, Christians United for Israel, Judicial Watch, NGO Monitor, the list goes on. Olivia, shortly after this organization singled you out on Twitter, your account was suspended. Can you tell us what happened?
So I actually came across this post from StopAntisemitism.org. I have just been like Googling myself and searching for myself on Twitter every day since I got doxxed, just to see what kind of threats are out there. So, you know, I was name searching myself on Twitter and saw this post from StopAntisemitism.org naming me as the anti-Semite of the week. Talking about my BDS activism, saying I fundraise for terrorists, and I am a founder of Democratic Socialists of America, which is funny because the founder of DSA, Michael Harrington, was actually a Zionist. Anyway, I honestly thought it was kind of funny at first. Like, you know, they just look delusional, very similar to Canary Mission. I think, you know, any reasonable person who looks at this stuff can see what's happening here. The fact that the majority of people featured on these sites are people of color, Arab, Muslim, or Jewish, you know, being smeared as terrorists. The fact that, you know, DSA was one of my main offenses of being an anti-Semite. It's very clear what the agenda is of these efforts, and it's to crush the progressive movement. And so I wasn't taking it very seriously until suddenly I went to tweet something a day or two later, and it said, that action is forbidden because your account is suspended. And I never got an email or anything about my account being suspended. You know, I've reported tweets before and I always get an email notification. I've seen when people have gotten their accounts locked or suspended, they get an email about it. And I didn't get one. So I filed an appeal with Twitter. And meanwhile, lots of people like were supporting and tweeting at Twitter support about it. And then yesterday I got an email from Twitter that said, you know, we did not find your account to be in violation of the Twitter rules and it has been unsuspended. So I was back on Twitter for about 5 hours last night. I went to try to DM a funny tweet to my husband and it said forbidden because your account is suspended. So I was suspended again last night. No email again, no reason given for why I was suspended. So I filed another appeal this morning. And as of now, that is still where it stands. I am still suspended. I'm sure that what is happening is that all of these followers StopAntisemitism.org are like mass reporting my account. And it's my understanding that Twitter's policy when that happens is to just automatically suspend the account when that happens, if it's not a verified account, which mine is not. So unless something changes with the way Twitter approaches this, I think that this is going to happen every single time I get back on Twitter. And I know it's happened to other people who just never get their accounts back. I'm lucky to have enough of a following, at least, that some people are tweeting on my behalf, asking them to look into this. But I know a lot of activists who just have to make new accounts or just are never able to get back on Twitter because of this kind of smear campaign and these targeted attacks.
These two attacks happen very close to each other. Do you think they're connected?
Yeah, and I don't think that these two incidents, me getting doxxed by fascists and me getting attacked by this site, StopAntisemitism.org, I don't think those two things are isolated. I don't think it's a coincidence. I think that StopAntisemitism.org came across me as a person because my Canary Mission profile was going around all these fascist forums after I got doxxed. They're saying, look at her, she's a terrorist. And we know that Adam Milstein, who funds this site, also funds Turning Point USA and Project Veritas and these far right-wing organizations that have the same following as the Proud Boys and 4chan. And it's very obviously related.
When you were in college, you were listed on the Canary Mission website. Over the past few years, your work and the leadership positions you've taken on have increased your public profile. Were you anticipating that this would eventually happen to you?
You know, this isn't anything that I wasn't expecting. I think that these escalating threats of violence and attack and smears are exactly what we expected as a result of the election. Whether Trump won or Biden won, we expected right-wing violence as a result, either they'll feel emboldened by a Trump win or they'll feel threatened by a Biden win. Either way, we expected them to target specific people, socialists, Antifa, BLM, or people they perceive to be in those groups, and especially vulnerable and marginalized communities, communities of color. And so this is something that we were all kind of bracing for. I also think, you know, I've seen some people talk about cancel culture and censorship, and the cancel culture discourse, of course, drives me crazy. I try to really avoid it. But the people crying about cancel culture are the right wing, or they're people like J.K. Rowling, who is a billionaire and is mad people are calling her a TERF. And I think getting called out for your shitty views when you are a person who holds this immense power is not getting canceled. That's not censorship. Activists getting removed from social media, losing their jobs, getting blacklisted, that is a growing problem. And that is something that BDS activists in particular have been facing since the start of the movement. I think that this sort of attack and this sort of censorship is not really supported or as acceptable as it once was in mainstream public discourse. I think the average person is not okay with this anymore in the way they might have just, you know, passed it in the past. And I think you even see that reflected some of the Democratic Party elected officials who at least defend the right to BDS and are becoming less scared to do so. But as our movement grows, so does the repression, because they're scared. They're lashing out because they're scared of us. And they know they can't stop what is coming. And, you know, I'm speaking personally for myself, not for the organizations I work for or represent, but I truly believe that the Democratic Socialist holds so much of the future of the left on its shoulders right now. And we are winning. I mean, I think we saw in the past election cycle that while the Democrats lost races, DSA now has 155 elected officials in the country. I think the socialist agenda is winning like never before in the United States, and they're scared of that. And the socialist agenda includes a free Palestine. And so as we build more power in DSA and with our allied organizations, they're going to keep trying this sort of repression, these sort of attacks. But I think that their power is waning. And I think the only thing we can do is kind of take it on the chin and keep moving.
Inside the Democratic Socialists of America, you've played an important role pushing the organization to endorse the call to boycott, sanction, and divest from the Israeli occupation. Can you tell us about how that work is moving forward inside the DSA?
Actually, one of the first I got involved in right after I joined DSA in 2016 was to help pass the BDS resolution that we passed in 2017. At our national convention. So DSA has officially endorsed and supported BDS since 2017. In 2019, we passed a resolution to establish this working group. So not only do we, you know, endorse it symbolically, but we're actually trying to develop work in chapters and nationwide in DSA to do BDS campaigns. And I think that that is exciting to a lot of people, especially, I just think there's a tendency on the left to work in these sort of issue-based silos. Like, I'm going to work on Palestine over here. I'm going to work on immigration stuff over here. I'm going to work on police abolition over here. And we never really make these connections more than like a transactional sort of solidarity. And that's, if we work that way, it's going to be impossible to win. And that's why I'm a member of DSA, because I know that we have to end capitalism. If we want any of these struggles to succeed, we have to draw these connections. And the connection is capitalism. And that is what we need to end in order for all of us to win. And so I'm really excited to see so many enthusiastic DSA members who want to work on Palestine, and members that have been working on Palestine for a long time wanting to bring it to the rest of the membership who might have joined for Bernie or because they want to work on the Green New Deal, or, you know, whatever issue that brings them to this sort of anti-capitalist big tent organization. We need to reach out to them and educate them and make them see how the struggle for Palestinian liberation is connected to all the other struggles. And I'm really excited about the fact that we now have over 85,000 members in DSA, and we're just going to keep building and building the movement for Palestine as well.
Where can people find out more about your work inside the Democratic Socialists of America and with the BDS movement?
You can find our working group at DSA_Palestine on Twitter. We're on Facebook as well. And you can find the BDS movement, of course, at BDS movement, and Portland DSA at Portland DSA.
Olivia, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today. We hope you stay safe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
In the days after this interview was recorded, Twitter reactivated, suspended, and then reactivated Olivia's account again. The photographer who took the photo of Olivia used by the Stop Anti-Semitism organization filed a copyright claim demanding it be taken down, but Twitter declined to do so. Olivia sent us this statement. Twitter has offered no explanation for this, and there is nothing preventing this from happening again, which I expect it will. This is clearly a result of the targeted harassment and smear campaign I've been facing for my activism, coordinated between far-right actors, actual anti-Semites, and Zionists. Meanwhile, the actual victims of hate speech and death threats, those who aren't in any position of power, like myself, will be the ones punished with no recourse. Unless this trajectory is halted in some way, anti-Semitism will be weaponized to crush all progressive grassroots activism, while actual anti-Semites will continue to spread their violent rhetoric, violent ideas, and inspire actual acts of violence.
So that's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Still looking for a holiday gift or two for the special people in your life? CKUT has new merch, including hoodies and t-shirts, that showcase classic designs dug up from our art attic. Head to ckut.ca to discover our new merch store and find out more about sizing and shipping. Happy holidays from all of us at CKUT.
In the fight against COVID-19, we must all continue to respect public health guidelines and follow self-isolation instructions. Self-isolate if you have symptoms. Self-isolate after testing. Self-isolate if the test is positive. Self-isolate when you return from a trip. And self-isolate when you've been in contact with someone who's tested positive. Self-isolation is important. Please, take it seriously. Learn more at quebec.ca/self-isolating. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Unique to nail, I washed away my fear. fix and trust in my own ears. My own regret revealed.
There is a place.